Time is now 1600 on 11 January. Finish sales 10 and 3, system performance, attendance and assets. AM3 and MA3 D Martino. MA3, do you have permission to take the conversation? Okay.
Alright,
I was going to refer to this cabin, okay? I'm going to kind of relax this a little bit. When I look at your assorted statements in here, something that jumps out at me is you signed a rights waiver certificate on September 4, 2009. This document here. Do you recall seeing that, signing that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, that was the day that I reported it.
All right.
That was when the Lieutenant Commander Wing, he took the first initial statement from me. I did sign that.
Okay, so it's Lieutenant Commander Wing, and he advised you to write.
Yes.
And what I find interesting, he has noted here that you're not suspected at this time.
Right.
Was that your understanding, that you were not suspected of committing any offenses at that time?
He did. That's what he told me to write.
All right, so have you ever been advised at any time that you were suspected of committing any violations of the CMJ?
Initially, before I reported this, I'm sure I was a lead suspect, because this thing was, you know, it was reported by the detainee, and, you know, the whole issue came up where I was going to be in a position where I had to cover it up or go along with the story and not tell the truth, and, you know, they let us know it is going to be a detainee investigation at our debt, and it specifically said they wanted to speak to the master, they wanted a voluntary statement from the master at arms and anybody else who was involved in the, time around the detainee.
Right, but when you were first talked to by Lieutenant Commander Wing, you were specifically told that you were not suspected of committing any criminal violations of the CMJ.
Yes.
Have you at any time been advised otherwise?
No.
Alright. Do you have an attorney?
No, I don't.
Have you talked to an attorney?
No, this is the prosecutor.
Okay. And what prosecutor have you talked to?
Lieutenant J.G. Kedlick. That's the only one I talked to.
How many times have you talked to him?
Probably 3 or 4 times.
Alright, do you think you've committed any violation of CMJ?
No.
And how long have you been in the Navy?
Also, it'll be 3 years on March 27th.
And where's home? Where are you from?
Riverside, California.
Graduate from what high school?
Jurupa Valley High School.
What?
Jurupa Valley. It's J-U-R-U-P-A. Valley.
What year did you graduate?
2005.
Alright, did you do delayed entry program?
Yes, I did. I began at January 24, 2007.
Alright, let's talk about your childhood growing up a little bit in high school. Do you have any problems in high school?
No, not at all.
Suspended?
No.
Okay, have you ever been arrested?
No. No criminal record at all? Not at all. No speeding tickets, nothing.
How about in juvenile court? A lot of times when kids get in trouble, shoplifting or something like that, what judges do is defer for a period of time and then dismiss it.
Right.
Anything like that?
No, nothing like that.
So you've never been in any juvenile court system?
No.
Never been in a police station? Never been questioned by police?
No.
When you came into the Navy, what was your intention as far as time in the Navy? Were you intending to make a career out of it?
Absolutely not. Just do my 4 years. Just join the military was something that I never really thought I'd ever do it in my lifetime. I started going towards a career path of law enforcement. And just talking to officers that have been, you know, successful in their field, they advised me that it'd be, you know, a good opportunity. It would look really good on me if I joined the military.
Okay. Why were you heading towards a career in law enforcement? What interested you in that?
You know, when I started junior college, my mind was just kind of going on, you know, I really wanted a direct path to take as far as a career. And I started looking around at different law enforcement agencies, and, you know, I found one that I was really interested in. Started doing a lot of volunteering with them, and I just fell in love with it.
Okay, now you made reference to college. How much college do you have?
About a year and a half.
This a junior college?
Yeah, junior college.
Okay. How do we need to finish it?
I dropped a couple of classes, mostly around the D range. A few C's there and there.
How would you refer to yourself as far as being a truthful person? You consider yourself a truthful
person? Absolutely.
Have you ever lied to anybody?
What's that?
Have you ever lied to anybody?
No.
Never.
I mean, in my life, yes. Like, lying to my parents and stuff like that when I was a little kid, yes. Everyone lies.
Okay, so how about teachers?
No. I never got in any kind of trouble.
All right, so you consider yourself a truthful person?
Absolutely.
Have you ever taken a polygraph?
No.
When did you get over to Iraq?
Landed there March 18th of 2009. And I was in Al Asad. And then I showed up to SEAL Team 10 on March
23rd, 2009. Okay, how did you end up in Iraq? Were you on an IA?
Yes, as an individual walking team.
Now, had you worked with teams before that?
Yes, I was actually with SEAL Team 7. We did basic soldiering at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and then we were TAD to SEAL Team 7. We flew out to the West Coast. We were with them from December 2nd to up until the time we deployed. We left the States the 16th of March. The troop I was assigned to for SEAL Team 7, they were going to Afghanistan. And there's a thing called a Noble Eagle number in our orders. They can't be changed.
Okay.
So they, instead of sending me that with the troop that I was originally assigned to, they decided to send me to SEAL Team 10.
All right, so you started SEAL Team 7 in December 2nd?
Yes, I arrived in San Diego December 2nd.
All right, now prior to December 2nd, did you have any involvement with Special Forces at all?
No, not at all.
How did you end up getting involved with Special Forces?
Yeah, it's just something that Big Navy says. You know, they put these bullets out, say, you know, hey, there's so many master arms that are needed for this mission. You know, it didn't require any kind of, you know, physical testing on my part, any kind of interview process or anything like that. They just, a deployment came to my command and said, hey, we need to send somebody, and they sent me.
So you didn't choose it necessarily?
No, I didn't choose it at all. They knew that I wanted to go to either Iraq or Afghanistan,
okay.
And it came up, so I was actually submitted for it, and I didn't even know. They just put me in for it.
Right. You have a secret, top secret clearance.
I have a secret clearance.
Has any adverse action been taken against your new clearance?
No.
All right, now when you're with SEAL Team 7, who would be your supervisor, so to speak?
It would have been MA1 Chase.
Spell that.
It's just like Chase, C-H-A-S-E.
Okay, so he would have known you during a time frame December 2 to 16.
Well, he would have known me from the time I was at Fort Dix, which was September 22nd. We got to Fort Dix, and we left there the 17th of November.
What's the first?
No, the 14th of November. His name is Reginald Chase. He might be retired now. He was at 19 years.
Oh, okay.
Or he was real close. He didn't make chief, so he might be retired by now. I don't
know
where
home is for him.
Texas. Okay. He's stationed at, it's a small base, something.
Corpus Christi, or?
It's like an hour away from that. Kingsland,
yeah.
Something like that. Kingsville, Texas, I think.
And who else would you say knew you pretty well when you were with SEAL Team 7?
All the master arms knew me really well. SEAL Team 7 was different than SEAL Team 10. The SEALs with them had like a completely different attitude. They didn't really talk to us. They didn't really interact with us at all. I really didn't talk to any SEAL. It was just like very small conversations here and there.
Team 7?
Team 7 was like that.
You were at page 13, adverse page 13?
No.
You've never been to mass at all?
No.
Alright, so you get with SEAL Team 10 when then?
March 23rd, 2009.
How many matches are on to have with them?
Just me and one other person.
Who was the other guy?
MA2 Cimino, C-I-M-I-N-O. For a time, and then he got fired, and then they made me delete the teeny hammer.
Why was he fired?
active listening to these fires?
The first detainee we got, it was pretty rough, but it was the first time. And the second one we got, he just completely botched it. And then he started being disrespectful to MC One Frying, and actually Lieutenant JG.
What do you mean he botched with the detainee?
He had no clue what to do with the paperwork, and he was expecting other people to do the work when it was really our responsibility.
Okay, was he formally relieved, or?
He was. He got chewed out, and then they pulled me in, and they told me that I was going to be the lead detainee handling, and it was going to be my responsibility.
And when was this?
I'd say about June.
And did they bring a second MA in to help you out?
No, he just fell under me.
All right, so he stayed there.
He stayed there.
Okay.
They were thinking about sending him out, but they decided not to because they wanted to keep it in-house, so he didn't get any kind of trouble.
All right, so you all just kind of flip-flop responsibility.
Yes. Yes.
During this time, you working for EOD-1 Franco as well?
No, it's EO-1.
EO-1, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. He was my... There were two LPOs. There was a CEO LPO, which was... That's the one who worked with.
Okay.
And then he was... They call us techs, enablers, whatever you want to say. And EO-1 was my LPO for that.
Okay. What kind of guy was Franco?
He's good to go. He's a really good guy. Very professional. Was always, very eager to help us out in any way.
Okay.
And he was your LPO?
Yes.
And you first kind of meet him when you got into Iraq?
Yes, he was... Well, when I first arrived to the SEAL Team 10 detachment, he was the first guy I met, actually.
You mentioned Fremont, too?
Yes.
Where did she fall in that chain of command, and what was her involvement with you?
She was just a... in the SEAL Team community, the debt we were at, it's very small. We had about... When we first got to be 50 guys, when this happened, I want to say we had like 35 guys, because guys were starting to head out. It's still close to our redeployment date. It didn't matter what your rank was, anything like that. Anything, I don't know if you guys are being around them, but anything you think of as far as, structured military, chain of command, anything like that, it all goes out the window. It's just a completely different environment. You kind of...
Good or bad?
I think it was good. It's relaxed, as far as uniforms, stuff like that. You didn't really refer to each other by their rank. It was all by first name. It's just a different kind of atmosphere. So, MC1, she's the first class I talked to her every single day. She was a combat, she's actually stationed here. She's a combat camera commander, whatever that is, and her job was just to go out on missions and stuff like that, or whenever you would fit, which is training of the Iraqi locals. She had to do storyboards and stuff like that, create PowerPoints for that.
Typical SEAL detachments, they don't comply with grooming standards or clothing standards.
We did. When we went out, around the Marines and stuff like that, we did. But typically, no. They don't cut their hair in high and tight.
Right, but how about you?
I kind of fell into it a little bit. Like, I let my hair go out a little bit longer.
Okay.
Especially when all the Marines left. No, I didn't shave for a couple weeks, stuff like that. Like, we were just a compound out by ourselves. I didn't shave, kind of walk around wearing flip-flops and shorts, tank tops, stuff like that. It's just kind of like the nature of their community.
Just see what that can
right. be. Right. Because, you get made fun of if you walk around there with a high and tight, because they think it's nerdy,
All right, so you had handled how many detainees prior to this guy?
Four prior to this guy. Yeah, it's three or four, because I know one off, they brought two brothers back. So that was two. When we very first got, I want to say four.
So one operation, there was two detainees came back, and they were brothers?
Yes, they're brothers.
Okay, and you had a second operation with one detainee?
Yeah, the very first one, we brought one back, or they brought one back.
And that was the first one?
Right.
All right, now, when they were running these operations, and also there's some issues, some stuff being classified here. We're not getting in any classified
right.
information. So
right.
you're going to have to tell us you think we're getting into classified information.
Okay.
When an operation is being run where there's a potential detainee being brought in, were you made aware of that
yes.
beforehand?
Everyone on the compound knows that. Everybody has, plays their little part, and I would have to know to
okay.
get ready.
So a strike team, so to speak, is going out to,
to take this individual down, you know that there's potential that this guy, the person, could be coming back in, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And what was the general operating procedures with detainees once they brought them back? How would they be handled?
They'd bring them directly back to our compound. It was just our screening facility. We had two little connex boxes. One was like a screening facility, and then one right next to it was like it just had benches in there. They'd bring them back there. And
we're talking actual connex boxes, right?
They're actual connex boxes. They're just converted into a screening facility. You can't even call them a detention center because we're not allowed to keep them there for...
All right. On the typical connex box, you have one main door, two doors.
It was...
was this modified?
It was one door. Yeah, there was wood modified, and they put an air conditioning in there, and then there was one door.
Broken down into rooms at all on the side? Or?
No, there was just like a... There's like little divisions in there. They built wood in there.
Okay. So an operation would be taking place. You're pretty much on notice that, hey, you may have somebody coming in.
Right.
And this is basically you and the other MA.
Yes.
Okay.
And then we pulled other people, other individuals from other raids and stuff like that to help us. We couldn't guard the guys for 24 hours or however long we had them. So we would take other guys, ISs, all the other guys, and they would help us watch.
And who would make determination? Who would come in and do that?
It was Samino. We would just, between me and Samino, we'd make a watch bill and say, hey, from this time to this time, you two have to watch them, this time, you two have to watch them.
All right, so once the detainee was brought in, run through the procedures as to how he would be handled once he got into your scenario, your situation.
With that?
Once the detainee came in and he was effectively, you know, the seals pretty much relinquished
right.
to you, tell us what would happen.
We would hold him for a little bit, just watch him. Usually, one of the first things to be done was a medical evaluation. H1 weatherman would go back there, and he would analyze him and stuff. And then we would pretty much just stand by, and we were, you know, we just did whatever Lieutenant J.G. Hyde told us to do, because he was always part of he was the interrogator and stuff like that. So we'd watch him for a little bit. And a lot of the stuff was just mind games that they play. You go in there, question them for 5 minutes, make them wait a few hours, go back in there, question them for 2 hours.
Would you be doing this?
No, I wasn't allowed in there because I'm not interrogatable.
Okay. So, I mean, the Lieutenant JG would come in or
yeah,
other people?
Yeah, he always had to have one witness, and there was a Marine out there that he was qualified to. I'm not even sure he was attached to. He wasn't part of NSW at all. He was just I think he was with the 1-7 Marines.
Okay. So, standard protocol, a detainee comes in, one of the first things that's done is going to be a medical evaluation.
Yes.
Pictures taken of the guy?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about the pictures. I mean, who takes the pictures?
It was always MC1. Right.
Okay. This with a standard 35 millimeter?
Some kind of heavy-duty camera.
Okay.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Right. Are they taking full-body pictures naked or just facial?
You're supposed
pictures?
To take, like, one dead-on, the side, like, at a 45-degree angle.
Dressed or undressed?
Dressed.
Okay.
We never, you know, to clothe them. It was always, you know, to look to see if they had any injuries or anything like that. We just lift the blouse, the gown up. And then for some reason, you had to take pictures.
You're saying, wait, are you doing this?
Well, I'd be in the room. There'd be multiple people in the room. And then they'd say, okay, lift up his gown. Okay, lift it up.
Now, since when the weatherman would be in there conducting his medical evaluation?
Around that time. You know, no, it's usually separate. The pictures and the medical evaluation was usually separate.
All right, but when you're doing the pictures, or you're looking for injuries to them?
Right, or any kind of markings or anything that would identify them, like
tattoos or...
Tattoos. The detainee that we're dealing with now, I bet he had his thumb was, like, amputated, or one of his fingers was amputated, so that's a telltale sign. That,
okay, we'll
you
stay
know.
Away from him. We're just
okay.
talking general right now.
Okay.
Okay, we'll get to him in a second. All right, so procedurally, the HM would do a medical evaluation. Would I assume write out a report of some nature?
It was just a medical one record. Sheet. It kind of had diagrams of the bodies. He would circle stuff if there was something wrong with them. And then it was like a bunch of yes-no questions. It wires a wire in it, and he would just circle yes,
right.
or no.
Have a translator in there for this?
Yes. The translator was always, he was always around.
Okay. Did you have one translator you were working with? Or?
It varied. No, there was our compound. I think we had like four.
Okay. So when HM1's working with them on the evaluation, there's going to be a translator in there so the HM1's can be asked the questions.
That wasn't a requirement, but it usually worked out that way. Where
right.
the translator was somewhere around the detainee.
After the HM1's done, then there would be on someone taking photographs.
Yes.
Okay. And are they handcuffed, restrained during this entire
process? The detainees, the entire time that they were in our custody, they are bound behind their back with leg cuffs, and they have some sort of mask on.
Okay, so yeah,
covering their face.
The entire time they have a mask on at all times.
Yes.
All right.
Even for the physical?
Yes. The only time that it's taken off is during the interrogation, because it's like an intimidation thing where they like to look at him in the face.
Well, how about and the physical? But how's the HM1 do with physical evaluation?
Oh, we would. We'd lift it up, like when you want to look at his face, he would temporarily lift it up, and we'd look, okay, he's good, and put it back down. Because it didn't really matter to that point when he was in the contact box. We just didn't want him knowing where he was at, and you didn't want him surveying our base.
All right. Were their legs restrained?
No.
And they always used flex cuffs and not handcuffs?
We never used regular handcuffs, but flex cuffs. We ran out of those. We just used it to...
All right, so the detainee comes and he's processed, medical, photographs. What happens now?
Whatever Lieutenant J.T. Hyde wants to do, we just watch him. When he wants to interrogate him, we escort him over. It's like a back and forth thing.
And when you're watching him, where's the detainee? Sitting down, standing up?
Sitting down.
In a chair.
In a chair. Or if we were in the other Connex box, then he was in the, on a bench.
On a bench, is he, secured to the bench or
no.
the chair at all?
No.
Alright, now, so there would be times when you would be in there alone, one-on-one on the detainee?
Not the previous ones, this was, I know you don't want to talk about the actual incident again, but that time I was.
Alright, but general protocol, you were not to be one-on-one on the detainee?
No, you always want to have at least one of
those. Okay, is that just your preference, or is there a general...
It's my preference, obviously, but I don't know if it's actually there should be. I would guess that would be some kind of directive or something like that.
Okay, but you weren't told under no circumstances are you to be alone with the detainee?
No, I was never told that.
With some of the detainees you had, who's the respect to that? Who's you and somebody else? Who else would be in there with you specifically by name?
It was mostly me and MA2 from Reno. Mm-hmm. We would stand watch together, and then he would pull. Like, I mean, I'd see these all kinds of guys just watching them for me.
All right, now, you're inside a Connex box. Where's the detainee versus where are you as far as distance-wise? Do you get close to this individual at all?
It'll probably be between me and Lieutenant, just about 4 feet, maybe.
And the detainee constantly has a hood over his head.
If he's not being questioned, any interrogation.
All right. Do you, in the normal scenario, do you have any physical contact with the detainee yourself at all?
Just when you walk from building to building or wherever they need to go, you always have to have solid control.
All right. What if the detainee indicates you he has to, take a leak?
That was my responsibility. I had to walk him outside and pull his pants down, stuff like that. He did his business, and I pulled his pants back up and walked him back inside.
Okay. I mean, did they have a head out there, or you
didn't
talk him? Because what if he had to take a crap?
If that happened, they just went dirt out there. And their culture, they don't use toilet paper, so
okay.
We just give him a bottle of water. And actually, that time, we did uncuff him for that, but we were watching him right there. Are you talking about Abed or whatever? He actually went out. He didn't. He never did.
Okay.
But other detainees.
The general procedures, if someone needed to go take a crap or whatever, you would escort him out there.
We'd walk him right outside the Connex box.
Take the flex cuffs off him.
It only happened once, and that one time we did.
And is that?
But if they had a pee, no, we didn't.
Is that under your SOP to take the flex cuffs off? So, I mean, is that easy for a detainee to get cuffs off by simply saying, hey, I got to take a crap?
No, it was, we didn't really have an SOP. It was kind of a judgment call. Like, hey, we're right here. There's not much you can do. If he starts getting froggy, then we'll take care of it.
All right, and again, talking generally speaking, how long would you, with these three prior detainees, how long did you have them in your custody, so to speak, before they were taken?
There are a lot of things where I don't know if it's considered OPSEC or classified or anything like that. Because obviously that would be a bad thing to get out for Iraqis to know. Because then they know, hey, they're going to get us, but they can only keep us for this amount of time.
Okay.
So that might be something classified.
Was there specific criteria as the max, as the how long? Okay, so you're concerned about the time as to be...
Right. I mean, I know exactly what it was, but it could be classified, so I don't know.
All right. They generally stick to that standard?
Yes. is usually before that time frame.
Now, was there interaction with Iraqi officials at any time with these detainees?
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about, you know, our guy in this particular situation. When did you first learn that there was going to be a mission to try to take him down?
From the very first time we got out there. It was Objective Amber. It was well known.
So he was a target from day
one? Yes, the team before us was trying to get him. The guys tried to get him. I want to say like the first week or two we were there. And then, you know, they're chasing him down the entire time. Finally caught up with him.
All right, now, how much involvement do you have in any type of, you know, planning operation?
None at all.
None at all.
I was the lowest ranking person there.
So you knew that they were looking for the guy, but you did not know, you know, specifics about it. On the night in question, when they actually took him down, where they were going after him?
Yes.
Before they went out?
Yes.
You didn't get, like, read into the specifics of the mission, though. You just kind of knew they were going for him, or?
There were times where I sat in on the briefs, but that's just because I volunteered to stand at Tarp Watch. I didn't really need to be there, but
this one, did you stand on the brief?
No, I was not on this one.
All right, so all you knew was that they were going out to get him?
Yes.
All right. And did you know who he was?
Yes. That was made very clear the entire deployment.
All right, now, were any special arrangements made in the event they were successful in grabbing this guy as to how he would be handled?
Well, usually there would, but this operation, because I made sure I clarified, he was not going to be taken in our custody. He was going to be taken off the bird and given straight over to the Iraqis. So I didn't have a watch bill set up
for the mission.
Yeah, that was already your
understanding
zone.
Is this guy
right.
Is not going to be kept in.
I was doing paperwork on him. We weren't keeping him. He was going right over to Fallujah Swap.
Where did you get that from?
It was just passed down from above. It might have been Lieutenant O'Neill. I don't know how I heard it, but it was something that was well known.
So you guys weren't necessarily prepared to take him?
No, I didn't have the training facility cleaned out at all. I didn't have a wash bill or nothing.
Didn't kind of adjust on the fly once you got there.
Right.
Do you know why that there was a snafu in that?
No.
Okay. So, were you physically there? And, I mean, how were you made aware they got the guy?
It's not a secret. Everyone knows we use, like, predators and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, I knew. Yeah, I knew. That
okay.
It's about the where I can hear the radio, stuff like that. They said jackpot, I knew. I mean, that's not obvious because everyone knows that we use those
all right.
cameras.
So, you were very well aware they had the guy, and now, at this particular point, you're still not thinking that the U.S. is going to maintain custody of him. You thought
right,
I'd
like to be turned over
to Iraqis. All right. When did it come to your attention that's not what was happening here?
We were outside. We actually took Lieutenant J.G. Hyde. He took the detainee back to the screening facility.
Okay.
And that's when he talked to him briefly. That's when MC1 Frank took the photographs and brought it back out. And for a short amount of time, I was out there. The detainee, we had this little compound right outside our compound that we kind of maintained for our partner force, which is Fallujah SWAT.
Okay.
And it was kind of like hangout. There's beds in there. It's like hangout spot for them. They took the detainee out of the truck once we were done with them and brought him in there. And
okay, well, let's take it from the beginning. The guy gets there in the truck.
Right.
Okay. He was brought in by helicopter,
yes.
Correct? And then he transported him by truck.
There's a bunch of trucks out there. I was one of the drivers.
What kind of distance between the helicopter landing zone and you know, where he's brought back?
It's probably maybe a mile and a half drive. It was only a mile and a half because we had to go all the way around. It was probably like 2-3 minutes drive, if that.
Were you involved with going picking him up.
Yes. Well, not him. I was driving the truck because I actually had Nida Keefe and McCabe in my truck, and I think an EOD guy in my truck. But the detainee, he went with Mr. Hart.
Okay, well, let's, again, slow down. The word is this guy's here. Okay, he's at your site.
Right.
At that particular point, the helicopter's landed. Do you go in the truck to get him?
We were already there when the bird landed. We knew they were
there.
We were there waiting. I saw the detainee come off the helicopter in custody of others.
All right, so you saw the detainee actually come off the helicopter.
Yes.
He walked off the helicopter?
Yes, he was walking.
Quick detail, what kind of helo was it? 60s.
60s.
All right, at that particular point, I'll see, did he have a hood on?
Yes, he had a mask on. He was bound.
It's not a hood. He had the goggles that were spray painted.
They weren't goggles. It was an actual mask.
It was an actual mask.
Right. Okay. Have you ever seen, like horses, they put those little fly masks over them?
Yes.
It looked like that.
Okay.
But it just covered his whole face.
Right.
And there's a strap in the back.
Okay. And he was restrained.
Yes.
Again, flex cuffs.
Yes.
On his back. You saw this.
Yes.
Were his legs restrained?
No. Because he was walking.
What guy on each arm?
What's that?
The guy on each arm, or he was walking?
I think there was two guys on.
Yeah.
Those guys were the wrong.
I can't swear to that. Something tell me that it was just an EOD-1. I thought I saw him around him, but it was so dark out there. All the guys look the same.
All right. Now, at that time, did you see Keith, McCabe, or Huertas there at all at that time?
Yeah, McCabe and Keith, I drove them back. But they were nowhere around the detainee. They just came off the birds and they got in my truck.
Okay, so you were in the truck that met the birds.
Yes.
At that point, you, Keith, and McCabe.
Back up then. You all get there in your truck before
Mr. Hyde, a Fallujah lieutenant, the detainee, and I think the interpreter.
Can you get back in the car if you have to talk about anything?
Yes, the cave. I mean, we were all just really excited, really proud that, you know, that they got this guy. McCabe and Keith, they're really, because the whole deployment, we just sat there, it was so boring. So
yeah,
to end up a deployment like that, with that much excitement and getting this guy to be the track and that whole time,
sure,
it was huge.
Sure.
And it was a really proud moment for everybody.
Sure.
Kind
of like a relief, they got him.
And right, and it was just, they actually, you know, the deployment was worthwhile.
Yeah. Anything much beyond that?
Clear view of Mr. They took a NASCAR from there. I didn't see
how long was he in that area?
Just a few minutes. I was outside talking to the lieutenant for Fallujah.
So this is the first time you saw him without his mask on?
I never saw him. First time? I never saw him with his mask off. I know that it was removed because he wasn't willing to talk unless it was removed.
Okay.
I never saw that guy's face until we were right after, or what I saw, yeah, until we were right about ready to turn him over when they were cleaning his lips.
Alright, and during the time frame he was in, you know, that area at that particular point, was he, did you see anybody physically manhandle him at all?
No.
Or nothing?
No.
Okay. And how long would you say he was in there?
Just a few minutes.
And then what happened?
Put him back in the truck, and we drove him back out to the gate, and then that's where we met, you know, Fallujah SWAT team. They were still out there in their little compound. We let him out there, and they took custody of him, brought him in one of the SWAT huts, and he was sitting on a bed, and they were kind of tending him. I still had an eye on him the whole time. And then I just overheard Lieutenant O'Neill talking to the Fallujah SWAT lieutenant, and they came to some kind of agreement that they were going to let the Fallujah SWAT guy get some rest, sleep for a few hours, and we would maintain him until that point, and then they'd wake up in the morning, and they could take him. So it's,
who was the talking here?
Lieutenant O'Neill and the Fallujah lieutenant.
So the game plan at that point is that the Fallujah SWAT team would be getting some rest in the U.S.
Right.
And custody.
Right. More or less just babysitting him because we weren't officially going to take custody of him. The whole intention was to still turn him over and he was going to go through their judicial system. on it. on an ATV, and he saw me walking into the teeny back there, and it must have been him that gone back and told somebody. But I don't know how HM1 Weatherman knew to come back and do the screening on him. I don't know. I mean, and obviously the SEALs, you know, followed him after.
So Weatherman's the first one to come.
Yes. I mean, did Weatherman go on the op?
Yes, he went on every op.
So he would have known that they had hit jackpot.
Right.
So he would.
But we weren't gonna do anything with this guy. We were just gonna.
You know, Neil might have told them.
That's a possibility.
But it'd be more sense for me for McCabe to go back.
So if he was just gonna be going over to the Iraqis, then would there not have been a medical evaluation?
No, there would have been nothing. There would have been no kind of paperwork or anything.
Nothing. Okay, literally they bring him back from the operation.
Yeah, it was just kind of like an informal, like, us watching him, like, never happened. Like, we just watched him for the Iraqis and turned him over.
All right. But in this one, you take him through the compound, you take him into the comics box at this point.
Yes.
All right. Is there a difference between the two comics boxes?
Yes.
Okay. How are they referred to? I mean, do they have numbers or names?
No, one we just call the screening facility, and the other one, I guess, would just be a holding facility.
Took him into which facility?
The screening facility.
Why you feel that way? you're gone. And you continued walking away.
Yes.
Why?
I knew that he had the capability of doing it, but Patty was still there. Agent 1 Wesley was still back there. And I didn't think, you know, it's just standing in front of him, there's nothing I could have said or done to stand in front of Higby that would have stopped him. I would probably have been beaten up before he got into the detain.
All right.
That's just the way he is.
You were the guy who had custody of this guy. Okay,
right.
A particular point, right?
Right.
And you made the determination that Weatherman watched for a period of time, but you knew if the shit hit the fan while you were gone, you had a problem on your hands.
Yeah, but I wasn't right next to the screening facility. I was already well on my way to my room.
Yeah, but you knew that Higby was going to the screening facility. He was looking for this buck stick.
Yes.
Okay. You knew that Higby was potentially somebody who could easily abuse this guy.
Yes.
Okay, and you just kept on walking.
Yes.
Okay. You didn't warn Weatherman?
I was already so far away from there.
Did Weatherman have any reason to know what Higby's reputation was at all?
Yes, everyone knows what Higby was.
All right. So Higby is a potential source of detainee abuse in your mind?
In my mind, yes.
Okay.
Had you ever heard that in the past? Anything like that?
No. But he talks a lot. He's about like his other deployments in Iraq, and, you know, situations that he's been involved in and stuff like that.
You guys kind of arrogant guy.
Yeah, he absolutely was. There was no question about that.
Has he ever indicated, had you ever heard of him abusing a detainee in the past?
No, but I mean, there were things that happened, you know, throughout the deployment with our own guys that made me kind of fearful of him. I wasn't scared of him. Like, obviously he's a big, burly, strong guy, but that didn't scare me. It's more of his mind that scared me, because laws don't apply to him. You know, he does things the way he wants.
That's just a loose cannon.
He's a loose cannon.
Okay.
You said he makes fun of people. Did you have, like, a run-in with him?
He would always joke around with me. He's just one of those guys. He's a SEAL. Whatever he said, I didn't argue. If he was come out and say, this guy's green, I'd been like, okay, cool. This guy's green. You know, you don't argue with him. He would make fun of me, you know, about, like, the way I'd work out. He said I'd run too much and I was too skinny, like, and I'd make fun of him. We had a pretty good relationship, but as a person, it's not a guy I'd hang out with.
Was he one of those guys who he was stealing and you weren't? It was pretty clear.
Yeah, I mean, there was times where he was so cool, and then other times, you know, like one time he saw me in this place, a little hangout spot we had called Danny's, and I just gotten off a convoy, and he looks at me and he was like, "What are you doing here? What do you want?" And I didn't even say anything. He's like, "Get out of here." You know, it's like for no reason. Yeah. It just seemed like he was constantly trying to prove himself and be Mr. Macho guy. And, you know, he would sit there. He's really into working out and fitness and stuff. And some of the stuff he did was interesting. And so, you know, it attracted attention to some other guys. We'd sit there and watch him work out. He'd be like, "Can I help you guys?" You know, like stuff like that. He was just a really, really arrogant person.
All right. And did, to your knowledge, did Higby actually get inside the screening facility when the detainee?
I never saw him go in. But, I mean, when I came back, he was in there. So, yes, I know.
So, when you came back, you saw Higby was in there?
Yes.
Okay. So, and you're gone for about 5 minutes. You come back to the screening facility, and Higby's in there, and Weatherman's in there?
And I want to say, I mean, I only remember leaving that screening facility twice. Once to get the paperwork and once for my rifle away. I could have left, you know, a person asked for more specifics on that would be Agent 1 with it.
Okay. But when you walked back to that screening facility after you got that paperwork, you went back in there and Higby and Weatherman were in there with the detainees.
And I mean, I want to say that could have been the time that the three guys were in there. You know, McKay, Porges, and Keith.
All right. At some point, did you see Higby with the detainees?
I know he was in there with the detainee, yes.
How do you know that?
Because I saw him in there. When I came back, I mean, I was scared to even go in there because I knew the way Carl was.
But you'd never seen him like that before?
No, none of them ever were. Horges is the only SEAL that would ever go back there because he was the LPO. He would go back there, kind of give him a look over every once in a while.
Yeah.
But it was nothing, you know.
Yeah.
All right. And if one occasion you saw Higby with the detainee, where were they in relation to each other?
I was never inside the actual screening facility with Higby.
Okay. But you knew Higby was in there with Titani.
Yes.
And everybody else, Weatherman in there?
I think Weatherman was outside. And I know why he was
Higby, you're telling us that Higby was, to your knowledge, in there with the Titani alone at some point.
Yes. Or, I know I saw him in there with other guys, and it could have been those three. Because one time I went in there, I know he was in there with McCabe at one point. Because, like, when I walked in, McCabe actually, the teeny was was sitting down. McCabe looked at me, and he said, oh, he's hurt, you know. And I'm like, you know, it's just, I just didn't know what to do. I froze. Like, once I knew that he was getting abused, I absolutely froze. I didn't say anything. I didn't move.
Okay, well, we haven't gotten to him being abused here. Right now, where we are, you go out to get your paperwork. You leave Weatherman in there with him. You pass Higbee on the way. You know Higbee's made the comment. You're concerned about potential. This is a source of detainee abuse. You keep going. You go on for 5 minutes. You come back. Okay, and when you came back, who was in that screening facility?
And that's what I'm trying to remember. Like, the more I think about that, I get more confused. Because I'm trying to remember when the three individuals were in there.
Well, I thought it was a bigger point. Didn't Workers or McCabe ask you where the detainee was at some point?
No. Well, I remember, like, I came back. It was one of the times I came back. And I remember looking in there, and I looking in and seeing those three individuals in there. And I remember there's another time I remember Higbee walking out, and he saw a look on my face, and he said, you know, he said, nothing happened back here. He said, relax.
All right.
And I think he got back on the quad and left again.
You said all this to the investigators in the back?
Yes, but I mean, when I was talking to the special agents and stuff, I mean, there's little things here and there that I would bring up, but they pretty much told me if I can't swear to it and stuff, then it might as well not even bring it up.
Okay, but when you bring it up, I mean, is this your handwriting on the statement?
See that statement?
This one?
Yes,
is,
that is.
September 4th. This is your handwriting.
That's my handwriting.
Okay. And this is the statement you made to...
Probably Lieutenant Commander Wing. I think that's the first statement I ever wrote.
So, when you make your statement to Lieutenant Commander Wing, you basically were told, if you're not certain about something, basically, don't say it, correct?
Nah, it was mostly the NCIS agents that told me that.
Okay, well, did Commander Wing tell you, you know, just guess at anything you want to guess here?
No.
All right. Did you know at that point there was an investigation going on?
Yes.
Okay, concerning detainee abuse?
Yes.
So you knew you better have your shit in gear as far as the facts you were given, correct?
Right.
Okay. Well, basically, you make reference to, I walked my room to look to see if I had the paperwork. I couldn't find it, so HM1 had to go to his medical clinic to get them. This is one of the two periods where I left the screening facility. When I returned, Higbee and Lieutenant Front Street, okay, was inside the screening facility. Okay, they left shortly after I returned. Okay, so that tells me this is not a question whether Higbee was inside the screening facility with the detainees. He was there and you saw him.
Well, that was, he came back on multiple occasions.
All right.
The first time I saw him, he came back on the quad. And then he just kept on coming back, you know.
How many times do you say Higbee was with that detainee?
I know for sure twice. But I know for sure twice.
All right. And at some particular point, did all right. When you came in, was Huertas, McCabe, and Keefe in there at some particular point?
Yes. One of the times I came back, I remember turning the corner and looking in and seeing those three individuals.
And you were gone, you know, two times.
I know, two times.
Okay, and
those
times,
those
one
times.
Time was to get the paperwork.
And one time was to my rifle back in my room.
And you left your rifle back in your room when you went back to get the paperwork, I take it?
No, that was it. That was a separate occasion.
Okay, why would you leave your rifle back in your room?
Well, when I left the first time, Agent 1, Weatherman, was watching my rifle for me.
So you left your rifle?
Yes.
Okay, what's protocol for leaving your rifle?
Big Navy, big Army, big Marines, you don't do that.
You don't leave your rifle.
But in our, you know, we all trust each other so much, it happened all the time.
Right, it may happen all the time, but what are your requirements as a master at arms when you have a weapon? Do you leave your weapon on somebody else?
No.
You have a military duty to maintain your weapon at all times, correct? To maintain
yes.
custody.
Yes.
You are not to allow somebody else to maintain custody of your weapon.